Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
And so that, I think, get rid of the nymphs in October. Fish your dry flies. You can move the bug around. You can dead drift it. You can fish a big October caddis, but you also need to be looking at gray drakes. Parachute atoms is a great imitator for that. You can have really nasty cold days and be looking at blue-winged olives as well. So it's really awesome dry fly fishing. Low water means the fish don't have to move a million miles. That short wing stonefly, which is not a good flyer, has pushed fish to the edges.
That was Chris Daughters providing some fall trout fishing bugs that you should be on the lookout for this season. The October caddis and their friends today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Please take a quick moment and share this episode with one other person that you think can use a blast of trout goodness today. Just click the link, the share link in your app down below and share that. Just send a text message out to somebody right now and they should be able to click right through and listen to this one. It's a good one. Chris breaks down the fall trout fishing today, so definitely stay in on it. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsor. Togan's Fly Shop, providing superior products at an affordable price. An amazing resource for fly tying materials, tools, and fishing accessories. Since 2005, Togan's has been over-delivering on price, service, and passion, and now it's time to discover the Togan's buzz for yourself. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's to get started today. You support this podcast by clicking over to take a look at Togan's online. That's wetflyswing.com/Togan's. T-O-G-E-N-S. Togan's. Chris Daughters, owner of the Caddis Fly Shop, sheds a little bit of insight on what it takes to find trout in the fall. We focus on some of the upper parts of the Mackenzie River today and fishing out of a drift boat. We find out which October caddis he uses and how he fishes them, his favorite leader setup, which crosses over towards the Euro game. And we also find out what happened when this blog post about fly names went viral. So this is kind of an interesting thing that was kind of out, and Chris describes his take on it, which is actually a really good one. I think it's a real positive take on everything there. So so stay tuned for that one. This and the stonefly with a hermaphroditic tinge. So without further ado, here is Chris Daughters from caddisflyshop.com. How's it going, Chris?
Doing very well, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for putting this together. It took us a few seconds there to get the audio together, but we got you on the squad cast here recording, so this is good. We're going to jump into the Caddis Fly Shop, the Oregon fishing blog, and you know, you guys are kind of leading the way down there in Oregon, and you know, I guess more towards the south and all that. But before we jump into that and a little bit on maybe kind of fall fishing, talk about how you first got into fly fishing.
I first got into fly fishing actually with my father at the Caddis Fly, the same store that I ended up buying. We both took a fly fishing course from Bob Gard and Jeff Carr and a bunch of guys, great guys that were working at the shop at the time, and you know, learned to cast in the traditional sort of Mel Krieger short but sweet fly fishing, fly casting course. It was about a 6-hour course. And I mean, honestly, right from there on, I remember my father buying a drift boat and fishing the Mackenzie constantly. We were already fishing the Mackenzie with conventional tackle. But then once we got into fly fishing, he quickly realized that when you're on the oars, you're not casting. So got me on the oars and him up front casting. And that was sort of the next step was suddenly I realized that I was guiding before I could drive. And that was fantastic. That was the next part of that career. But I mean, I literally walked from school to the caddisfly from age 12 till I could begin to drive from school to the caddisfly. And from that class of casting, took another course on tying flies, and then started tying commercial elk hair caddis for $9 a dozen, believe it or not. Which was good, which was great money at the, you know, 13, 14, 15. So that was a blast. So it was really, the shop was really my support center. I was there more time than I was anywhere else. If I wasn't at the river, I was at the shop, and it was a great experience then. And I still really enjoy it.
No, that's cool. I didn't realize that, there was somebody there. I didn't know the whole history on the shop. So the guys there, do you know a little bit of that history? Like when the shop actually, when those guys started it?
Well, Bob and Kathy Gard started in 1975, a little bit longer than a stone's throw away from where the shop is now. But we've been in four locations in and around downtown Eugene since 1975. We've been in the current location since 91. Which is on 6th Avenue. It's a great, you know, thoroughfare. So it's a good location. So that the shop and the history of the shop are, kind of ingrained into Eugene. I mean, all the local fishing clubs and have been really supportive and local community and hopefully we've done the same giving back as much as we can. So it's been a great environment for the caddisfly to be in since 1975. I mean, we've had, there is another fly shop in town, and of course there's a Cabela's and all the same stuff that everybody else is experiencing, but really have been fortunate to you know have all the best brands and names and support in the industry. So it's been a great situation.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I mean, I think the Oregon fly fishing blog too, right? I mean, you're well known, that resource is out there for sure, all the videos and you know, and the good resource there. So it's been, you know, it makes sense that you're one of the big names when people think probably, you know, in that area, if not, you know, the region. Okay. And so basically what year was that when you purchased, took over the shop?
In 1996. So I was about 26 at that time. And Bob was ready to move on. I mean, I think he'd been into the, so that puts him at 21 years in retail. And he was really involved throughout, you know, which I think can wear on people. I've been lucky to have a little different circumstance. And like I said, I still really enjoy retail, but the store was, you know, in great shape, but no online presence, and kind of the online thing in fly fishing was just kicking in. And we actually had a brief partnership with another sort of more tech savvy person, in the early 2000s and then kind of started on our own in earnest in late 2007, 2008. And that was also about the same time that Oregon Fly Fishing Blog kicked in. And that was a guy named Matt Stansbury, who's since moved to the Eastern United States, but is still a good buddy and, you know, still has some great advice. If I ask him, he's an awesome writer and, he's still active in his own local community, but, was really, as co-founder of Oregon Fly Fishing Blog, he was, you know, a great guy and, got us, you know, involved in sort of conservation projects and contests and more, you know, so savvy internet stuff, And I've had to learn all of that. You know, I really honestly came in absolutely blind and that's been as many of us have had to kind of grow with that part of business world in the last 20 or, you know, 15 years or so. It's been fascinating.
And who is that again that helped you with the online stuff?
Well, Matt really helped me with Oregon Fly Fishing Blog.
And that was Matt who?
Matt Stansbury.
Okay.
And he's, you can still find Matt. I mean, Matt is still writing a lot. He's in North Carolina right now, but, he's just a fantastic writer. I mean, I would suggest to anybody that can find his stuff, or of course there's a lot of stuff on Oregon Fly Fishing blog that people will know, but he's really got a great style for his writing.
And when we look at the blog, I want to just touch on that just kind of quickly, because I think it is a good resource. How would you recommend if somebody wanted to find some topics? Is it best just to start from the most recent stuff, or is there a way to search? It sounds like there's many years of content there. Is there an easy way to find what you're looking for?
Yeah, there is a search tab that you can utilize, but there's also those where you can attribute the post to a topic, and those topics are on the right hand side in a column. So they can be fishing reports, conservation, fly tying videos, Mackenzie River, Deschutes River, Umpqua River. So you can see those and click on those, and that will kind of drill it down. But you can type in anything. I mean, you can put in spay lines or sink dips or whatever matches or fishing reports, and that's going to filter it a little bit for sure.
So if you wanted to search for, say, for example, fall fishing, fall trout fishing, October caddis or something like that, could you find some articles there?
For sure. October caddis would be a really good one. Yeah. You get videos and fishing reports there.
Oh, good. Good. And the videos are the videos more like flight time videos, and or do you actually have stuff out on the water?
No, they're all going to be like flight time videos primarily. Very little on the water. Yeah. And our fly tying videos, they're not studio quality, as many in the industry have really stepped that up, which is awesome. But I think that our content has been genuine and proven about that.
Well, we'll hopefully talk about this if we have time. I know Jay Nicholas, and he's been a big part of writing a lot of the videos over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
he's awesome.
And he's known as one of the, definitely one of the passionate, one of the best out there as far as what he does. So that's good. Okay. So that gives a little taste. And so basically it's since 96, you've been going there, and it sounds like you do a little bit of the guiding, a little bit of everything in the shop, and you have staff. How many staff do you have there?
We have about 10, right now. And I mean, it's sort of, yesterday was interesting. It reminds me of sort of my start. We had a kid, Owen, who's worked for us for the last spring, summer. And, he's going out to college. And I was kind of thinking, like, the Caddisflies always had like a history of hiring young kids. I was one of them. We'll virtually break labor laws here in the 13, 14, 15 year old kids, get them into the store. They're passionate. They want to learn. They'll do anything. I remember, being in a, windowless storage room, pouring bulk cement into glass jars, mothballing giant bag, 20 by 20 boxes of Marabou. We'll do anything because we love it, and trying to, and you glean all the information that you can from the guys that work there.
Exactly. So you're still able to do that? Can you actually take a kid and get them in there, legally or whatever?
Yeah, no, you can. Yeah. So, Owen is old enough, but, we do. And I think that's, I like that about a fly shop. Always, you got to have that young energy around for sure.
And how did that feel when you first, in 96, when you, you purchased, actually officially purchased the shop?
It was awesome. I mean, it was, in a, like maybe 10 years prior, that was like a dream, to be truthful. I mean, that wasn't really on my radar. I wasn't thinking that could ever happen. I mean, I had a 1976 Dodge pickup, to give to collateral to the SBA, for my application. So it was there wasn't really a lot, of financial backing there. So yeah, it worked out good. And, Bob made it happen too. Which was good of him. So it's been fantastic. I mean, I've just been so lucky that the river runs through it. Part of it was phenomenal.
Was that about that time when you first bought it?
It seemed like it was in there. Yeah. Yeah. That was like when the store was going absolutely bonkers, and, you just had so many people getting into the sport. And then after that, you kind of saw the internet come around, and you know, that's been great as well. So I think I've been in a, you know, timing wise, a great time in the fly fishing business. And locally, we are just super fortunate to have a kind of a growing community, the University of Oregon around us, two rivers that run right through town, a tremendous amount of fishing in Oregon, as you know. So it's a pretty idyllic situation.
Well, I wanted to dig into, you know, there are a lot of things we could dig into. Obviously, there's steelhead fishing and there's a bunch of rivers, like you said, up there. I was kind of thinking obviously the Caddis Fly Shop, you've got the caddis all the day, the fall caddis, if we had to dig into a topic, is kind of interesting to me because, you know, caddis are an important species out there. You know, if you take us the river and think of that fall, you know, as you're preparing, say, for that October fishing, can you kind of just take us to the water? And I don't know, is the Mackenzie, like, where would you be going? Would you be hitting in the fall? Would you be hitting the Mackenzie or the Willamette? What would you be doing?
Well, I like both drainages, but in the upper reaches a little bit. I mean, depending on how cool that water in the lower end has gotten and how fast, you know, like later in the fall, the lower Mackenzie and lower Willamette are going to fish well. But my personal favorite would be to get in kind of that upper reaches of the upper Mackenzie, say, you know, from milepost 50 in that range, 10 miles up or 10 miles down on Highway 126. Or if you're going to talk the Middle Fork of the Willamette, we're going to be near the town of Oak Ridge. And both of those are fantastic fall caddis fisheries. But I have to mention, and this has been probably the last 10 years or so, but prior to the October caddis, but still in the fall, is that short wing stonefly, which I think I first encountered in Idaho, South Fork of the Boise, but has grown in importance in my tactics locally. Very interesting bug. Arlen Thomason discusses it in his book Bug Water. You don't find a lot of other discussions about it, though. It's a largely nocturnal stonefly that occurs in the fall, and it is really good fishing. I mean, it's an underrated emergence of stoneflies in terms of when I talk to people about it. I don't hear a lot of people who really have it dialed in. So I'm going to be thinking like that in kind of early fall. And then, of course, as we get on and we start seeing October caddis, you know, you can fish anything orange and have a shot for sure.
And early fall is for that that the stonefly. What is early fall? Is that like
first 2 weeks of September is the beginnings, and on often it is well over with by October 1st. So it's earlier than the October caddis, and the October caddis can drag on into November. For sure. We've had mild falls or early winters where you can have great dry fly fishing well down into the lower Mackenzie and Willamette on October caddis.
That's right. So basically October caddis, and once you hit, it is October still. I mean, that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed. You can fish October caddis as early as the first couple of weeks of September for sure. But I typically, I'm gonna see that happen around the 1st of October and through mid-November, assuming water conditions don't blow out, which I'm kind of hoping they do this year because we need some water.
Exactly. So, well, let's just stay on the Mackenzie since that's, you know, we have a couple rivers we could fish. But if we talk about that Mackenzie, that upper kind of the upper reaches. So talk about, you know, again, let's maybe go back on the river. And are you guys doing the drift boats? Is that pretty much how you're fishing?
Yeah, we do. I have one of those Outcast ambush rafts as well for a single guy in super low water. But yes, drift boats are 99% of what we do. We have a guide service that does the upper Mackenzie, and a lot of the guys do that upper river. And it's sort of technical boating, you know, lots of rocks to hit, lots of rocks to avoid. But that also means that there's a ton of pocket water, a ton of great, you know, all day fishing. Like you don't like sit down. You can be casting literally the entire day in that upper end. It's awesome. Good wild fish, rainbows and cutthroats, and spectacular scenery. So it's a great stretch of river.
Okay. So basically that puts us there. So you're on the water, and as you're going down, I guess it depends on the water levels, but you know, maybe just start us off with the flies first. If we're talking that caddis, I mean, are you guys kind of focusing on, you know, fishing a bigger bug there with a dropper? What's that look like, your setup?
Well, you can fish hopper dropper where, and we do a lot all spring and summer with a chubby Chernobyl and a, you know, like a Euro style jigged nymph. That's become kind of the favorite tactic. But, you know, I've had some awesome days where, you know, we'll do like a foam bodied October caddis. I think that's Moorish foam October caddis, or, a really big orange elk hair. You know, cut the nymphs off. I mean, I think it's the I think it's that time of year where you got to just be a little more disciplined about your dry fly fishing and talk yourself into as a guide of just get rid of the nymph. You know, you don't need it anymore. Those fish are looking up. You have lower sun angles. You have those overcast days. Even on the cool mornings, late in October, I have often been very surprised at how good the dry fly fishing is. You know, even when it's really cold. And I think a lot of times you have those bugs struggling to move as well, and the fish know it. And so that I think get rid of the nymphs in October, fish your dry flies. You can move the bug around, you can dead drift it. You can fish a big October caddis, but you also need to be looking at gray drakes. Parachute atoms is a great imitator for that. You can have really nasty cold days and be looking at blue winged olives as well. So it's really awesome dry fly fishing. Low water means the fish don't have to move a million miles. That short wing stonefly, which is it's not a good flyer, has pushed fish to the edges because they're looking for those bugs on the edges. October caddis, the same. You've got fish that have moved over to the edge of the river, so you don't have any trouble finding fish on October caddis adults in very shallow water near the shore. You've got salmon spawning first few weeks of that kind of third week of September. That's in full swing. So again, trout move over to the edges. And I just think it's a great time to be fishing dry flies, large, mid to large size October caddis. It's a great time of year.
There you go. So yeah, and that's those are some good tips. Basically, yeah, the edges is, I mean, when you're floating down, is that typically when you're in the drift boat? I mean, there's probably areas where you find structure, but is that like 80% of the time you're fishing, you're drifting in the middle of the river and casting towards the bank?
Well, I would say that's actually where I wouldn't say that we don't do that, but I would say that's where the Mackenzie kind of differs from some of the rocky streams. You know, we're not 100% directed at that. The Mackenzie is really a Chinook salmon river is how I think about it. It's historically the salmon were, and I hope continue to be, kind of the key ingredient to that river's success. So those spring Chinooks come up in May and June and July. They sit down in the deepest, coldest pools of that upper river. And you know those big trout do the same thing, right? So when they're in the midsummer, when they've got splash and giggle traffic over them all summer in pretty low water, I'm really convinced that those fish move to that deep green water and that's where they settle. Now, do they go out on the edges in the fall? Yes, but some of those fish still hang in that deep green water. They'll still come up, but there's no doubt you want to concentrate on fishing, you know, mid river around giant boulders or some just gorgeous, you know, sort of volcanic structure up there in mid river that I'm definitely going to fish to.
Okay, so basically you're open to fish. You're not just focused on the bank. There's going to be some area, especially.
You're really not. Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes when that short wing stonefly hatch happens, that's, you're going to need to do that. But as you move into October caddis time, you need to be looking everywhere.
Okay, and that's that short wing stonefly. So you mentioned the Bugwater book. I'll put a link in the show notes to that book so we can dig into that. But that's. Yeah, I think I've seen those as well. I mean, they basically don't have, it's almost, they don't have a wing, right? I mean, it's just super tiny. They can't fly or anything, right?
I think it's the male that can't fly at all. And that book, by the way, you know, I mean, I grew up with Western hatches, just, you know, like referencing it constantly, Dave Hughes and Rick Halfley, it was just an awesome book. But to me, that's the modern Western hatches. And he does such a great job of explaining it in, you know, non-entomologist terms. I can't recommend that book anymore. I mean, it's so good.
I'm excited for that book. That's great. Yeah, because Western Hatches is kind of like one of the, you know, Bibles. One of the big. Yeah, exactly. It is kind of the Bible. But there's actually, this one's actually newer. So this has come out since then.
Yes. Oh, much. Yeah. No. And Arlen had like fish tanks in his front yard. He was running water through for bugs. And I mean, he did. He's really worked at it. It's tremendous.
Is he like local down there or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, nice. That's perfect. Okay. Well, that's a killer resource. So, and I think, I'm not sure, we may have joked about, you know, when we're on the river, like, I think maybe it's a hermaphrodite. I'm not sure if that's what that short winged stonefly is, but I remember I was talking to somebody, I think one of my buddies, Shannon, was mentioning that, you know, because we'd see him on the Deschutes as well, right? Crawling around at night. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like you said, you'd see them at night. They'd pop out and wow, these things, what's the deal with these stoneflies? And they're good size, right? They're pretty, they're not like.
They really are. Yeah. They're like a golden, you know, like a Deschutes golden stone size. Yeah.
Cool. So, and is it Arlen?
Arlen, A-R-L-E-N. Thomason.
Thomason. Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'll definitely. That'll be awesome to get a little background on that. So. Well, it sounds like we're getting a little feel for it. So you're floating down and you guys do what? You do a lot of day trips. Is that kind of the typical guide trip you do up there in the fall?
Yeah, we do. You know, we don't do any overnight stuff. And that is one thing about the fall. It's fantastic is that kind of midday is the best. You know, you can start earlier, but your best fishing can often be between 10 and 4. And when you lose that sun completely and that cools down, it can shut down pretty quickly, especially late in October on the upper river. You've got a little bit of elevation and you lose all your heat. And, you know, I think those fish definitely feed midday more than any time. And I'm talking later October, mid to late October when I say that.
Mid to late October. Yeah. So if you're out there in late September, it could still be 100 degrees, right? Like depending, maybe not 100.
Yeah, but it's... And I think again, you lose some traffic and you lose a little bit of that light right overhead, and you've got the salmon going. So those fish tune in pretty early in September.
So again, we're going back to that. So you mentioned the Moorish. I think he must have a foam like an October caddis, but there's some flies. But you're saying don't be afraid to just cut off your hopper dropper and just go straight with the standard caddis. How do you know when to go with that caddis? I mean, are you seeing them just when you see them around? Is that time to switch to just the caddis?
Yeah, I think you're seeing some caddis. The upper river has a more Metolius river like bottom structure and insect population. So we have a variety of mid-sized rust colored caddis throughout the year, and then those will still be going on in the fall. And then so I don't think that it's just that prevalence of the October caddis that makes these fish go up. I think it's a variety of conditions as well as insects. Because a lot of times the October caddis, it's not like you get to view fish smashing these things as they're dead drifting down, you know, on the bank. It's just that they're rarely available to fish much of the year. But they do, when they do oviposit or lay their eggs, they're really dapping and really active, and that just turns those fish's heads up to look at anything. And so I think once that begins, in you can start fishing a lot more dry flies.
Okay, and that typically begins sometime in October. You don't know exactly when, but is there a rough time? If you said somebody was planning a trip, you know, with you for a day up there, you know, right now, would you say, you know, mid-October, or you just don't know?
Well, I'd say anytime after October 1st. I mean, mid-October, you're in it for sure. Yeah, you are. You are. But, you know, you also say that, hey, it could be a pretty nasty day in mid-October. That hasn't been the case for the last 10 years, but I'm still arguing back to when we actually had falls and winters. But it could start in the first week of October for sure.
And let's go to the fly box a little bit, because you've mentioned a few. You mentioned this stonefly. We're talking about the October caddis. There's some other smaller caddis. What's your box look like when you're getting ready for that October? Or somebody was planning now for that October trip. What should their box, you know, and we could talk nymphs, right? Do you also have some caddis nymphs that you use as well?
I got to be honest. I'm not a big October caddis nymph, you know, to really imitate that bug. I haven't cracked that code, or I haven't tried too hard. We sell a ton of those nymphs. I thought that mostly it seems like they're for steelhead on the Rogue, but I don't tackle that as much. Although I will say that, you know, one of our number one nymphs, and I'm sure this does a reasonable job of it, is like an oversized posse bugger, which is become kind of a favorite fly for guides and anglers locally for many, many years. And it was a fly that Dave Hall created of Umpqua when he was there when they had an excess of possum skins from New Zealand or Australia, I forget where. And so it's like a possum body. But I think the key to that fly and to many October caddis nymphs is just that black collar, that sort of that real contrast between the black head and the rest of the fly. So that's what I'm looking for in a nymph. And there are many specific October caddis nymphs, Andersons, and I think Moorish has some, and some are just called a tungsten October caddis. I know, and Rainey's got a stick caddis. And I think many of them just need that contrast between head and body, whether it be black to orange or black to tan, and they're oversized, of course. They're pretty big. So I think that's something that you would do earlier. So that's something I'm going to do in September more than I am going to be in October. One thing interesting about that hatch, and I'm Arlen could do more for it here, but it seems like those bugs come out and then they're around for a really long time sometimes, you know, the October caddis adult. So that nymph is, you know, on an annual cycle, right? It's going to come out, it's going to be active in, you know, maybe late or well, mid-September all the way to emergence, let's say October 1st. And these are just rough dates, of course, but so that's kind of your nymph period. And then that adult comes out. And then, as we talked about it, it's not always active on the surface, but it's available for a really long period of time to those fish. It's often very, very late in the year when there are just like so many October caddis out on the surface. You're like, where do I start? But those are rare days where you really see a ton of those bugs on the surface or all laying eggs at once. So I think that's kind of the cycle, is to kind of look to nymph with a larger October caddis nymph mid September on, and then move to the dry flies October 1 on. And if I'm going to nymph, that's not one that I'll probably do as a hopper dropper, just because those nymphs tend to be kind of eights. And, you know, I need to dedicate myself to getting that fly down, either into maybe using that October caddis as a bottom fly on a two fly nymph rig, where the upper, up bottom fly is the October caddis, and up above that, I've got a smaller pheasant tail or, you know, sort of blue winged olive type imitation or gray drake nymph imitation, which is just be a general mayfly nymph in like a 14, something like that. So that's how I would approach the nymphing strategy to the October caddis. I'd do it earlier in the season than the adult, and I would dedicate myself to the bottom. And once I get to fall, if I'm going to use that October caddis as a hopper dropper, I'm probably going to go away from an October caddis nymph as my dropper, just because it's so heavy. It's going to sink any dry fly virtually, even a chubby. I suppose a chubby would hold it up reasonably well, but I just don't think you need to. You can go to a more slender Euro jig type nymph, which just seems to murder them all the time anyway. I mean, I like the style of the fly. I'm not a huge, I mean, I obviously I teach it and I know how to do it and all that, but I just like the way those flies sink. And that's critical in the upper Mackenzie or upper Willamette, is that, you know, like drift boats flying down the river, how quickly can that nymph get in the bucket underneath the big dry fly? So those flies are just absolutely perfect for us.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Togan's Fly Shop, providing superior quality products at an affordable price, an amazing resource for fly tying materials, tools, and fly fishing accessories. Togan's has you covered when looking for unique in-house products, but also supports and supplies materials and tools from other leading fly brands you know and trust. Togan's is now offering their mystery fly tying box, where they simplify the process for you in choosing materials. You're only one click away from these hand-picked subscription tying boxes that are packed with value at almost half the cost. And I recently made a order through Togan's, and the experience was perfect. After a recent trip nymphing for trout, I had to replace my tungsten beads and some jig hooks and a few other items. The products arrived in a couple of days from Togan's with a nice little card, a bonus value, and a welcome note from the Togan's family. Since 2005, Togan's has been over-delivering on price and customer service, so it's time to discover for yourself what the buzz is all about. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's and take a look at their diverse selection of products today. You can support this podcast by clicking over to take a look at Togan's online. That's wetflyswing.com/TOGENS. Togens. Okay, now back to the show.
Yeah, so you're not necessarily, well, like you said, I mean, you've got the tungsten bead on there. So that thing, that's key for you, getting your nymphs down and where you guys are fishing.
Yeah, the tungsten bead, and now these, what are these new things? Umpqua calls them jig bombs. Hairline calls them, there's something like that. But, you know, it's a little bit different than a traditional bead. Yeah, so they're really, they sink even faster.
Nice. I'll put a link out to that as well in the show notes. So this has given us a good, now we talked a little about nymphs. Maybe just before we leave this nymph conversation, describe again that leader setup. So how does that look if you are fishing the big October with a small BWO or something else? How are you doing your leader?
Well, I hate to talk about this as a retailer. Can I take no comment? No,
yeah.
I'm kind of building my own leaders on that program. I'm building a really short, stiff section. This is really designed for the local scene, but I'm sure it works everywhere. I'm going to either cut off a 9-foot leader back, you know, cut 60% of it off, or I'm going to take two chunks of Maxima, 25 and 15, tie them together in a short section, tie a tippet ring on that so that I can go from 15-pound Maxima to like 4X. So it's that's the critical junction. Above the tippet ring, I'm going to tie a dropper line where my dry fly sits. And then below that, at whatever depth you want, I'm going to have my Euro jig. But whatever. I mean, I'm talking hopper dropper leader here. If I'm going, I can discuss the nymph leader too, if you want, but that it's not going to be that much different, right? Because the key is whatever you're using as your indicator below that, whether it be a dry fly or whether it be an indicator, the key is that transition between indicator and fly being as thin as it can possibly be to relate to the Euro style fishing, right? I'm not Euro style fishing with this rig because I'm often doing it out of a drift boat, or I just don't want to do that. But I'm trying to get the sink rate to be max by using the smallest tippet within reason off that tippet ring closest to my indicator.
So basically you're doing some like fluorocarbon for your tippet.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, that doesn't matter that much. These flies have gotten so heavy. If you're not into fluorocarbon, then I don't, you know, this is not a big deal.
Yep, just whatever. Just use 4X, yeah. 4X and a tippet ring.
Right. I mean, years of old, I mean, very simply, we cut a 9-foot 4X leader in half, blood knotted it together. That became the stopper, right? And now the dry flies above that stopper and the nymphs at the end of the 9-foot 4X leader. Okay, that's one way for someone to do it that likes tapered leaders. The downside of that tapered leader is from your dry fly, now that you've used it above that stopper where you retied it together, you now have what, 20-pound test? So you're trying to sink 20-pound test along with your jigged nymph. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It did work. Somehow we caught fish for years. But you know, you can do it better. That's the point. But you cannot tie, you know, 20-pound whatever to 4X with a conventional knot very well. Hence the tippet ring transition.
That's why the tippet ring is so huge, is that it allows you to do that. And you're basically, you said 4X. So Ed, how long is your tip from that tippet ring down to your fly, your nymph from the end?
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting, that's a good question, and it's often only about 4 feet, but it can be longer depending on the run. And to be truthful, I don't mess with it a whole lot. I kind of fish it till I go, oh, it seems a little too short. But in the fall, it almost never gets too short. And then I ask myself, why aren't you just tying it off the bend of the hook? And then I say, wait, casting that sucks. The system that I just discussed is way better because you're only casting that nymph and the dry fly simply along for the ride. So I think that's the key to that. And I think to our discussion about the fall, shorter is fine. You know, 4 feet might be too long some days. Don't need it. What's happening in terms of developmental stages of insects in the late fall? It's winding down. We're seeing everybody that has emerge, or we're at the tail end of it. Blue-winged olives, gray drakes, October caddis. What's really going to emerge in December? Midges, not important on the Mackenzie. So I think you can kind of say, hey, that bottom range of the river, you don't need to roll stonefly nymphs, I guess is my point. I'm not saying it won't work, but I think you can kind of elevate your whole system, whether it be just fishing a dry fly or when you do that hopper dropper, shorten your drop.
And one final thing on that. So on that, what you describe with the leader, so you have the tippet ring. And then if you are doing a hopper dropper, the hopper is above that tippet ring. And how is it tied on to the leader? What sort of knot are you using to get the dry fly on there?
Well, I've experimented with both tying direct into the ring, which I don't like. Or what I do is I tie a double surgeon's or perfection loop on a 5-inch piece of monofilament. It's not on anything. And then I overhand it over the top of the main line that leads into the overhand, that leads into the tippet ring. So it can slide because it's just a overhand loop, but it doesn't because it's tight and it's jammed up against that tippet ring.
Okay. And then, like you said, if you're doing a nip, if you're just take off the dry, you just take off the dry and fish that same setup as a nymph.
Yeah, you could screw on one of those airlock things and extend your leader and you're there.
Okay, well, that gives us a little rundown there for both nymphs and dries. And yeah, I guess, anything else to shed, any other big, you've mentioned a number of different hatches, but I guess if we're thinking that early stone, you get some October caddis, and then you get obviously all the other caddis, right? Different sizes, the normal size 12s and 14s that are flying around like crazy. Are you getting big caddis hatches of those out there?
I don't know that I'd call them big, but they're substantial enough to get fish going. As early as September, I'm fishing, a size 14, Swisher's dancing caddis is a favorite. I like that parachute, really, sort of almost overdressed smaller caddis that floats regardless. I really think that I, on the Mackenzie, and we've even created flies as a kind of our shop overdressed, we call them heavy hackle parachute atoms or heavy hackle this. And that is kind of a guide thing where you just don't want to mess with your fly. You just want it to float. So that's kind of my strategy on smaller caddis too. Give me something that's got a good deer hair wing, a good parachute hackle, and is highly visible even in the 14, 16 range. And those are great patterns to be fishing all through the setup. If I've got somebody that's struggling to cast a really big fly or I've got a fish that, just is being a bit picky and I need to fish a smaller, longer leader, I'll put on a smaller caddis all through September, October and do well too. And even earlier, this season, I with low water and warmer water earlier, and that I just kind of convinced myself that I needed to fish smaller flies more and dry flies. And that's what I did. I fished a lot of parachute atoms and parachute caddis, and they work great.
And as you go into, we're talking October, November, at what point does the fishing really slow down? I guess it slows down for dries, but are you guys fishing through the whole winter out there?
We're really lucky in that regard. As I said, the lower Mackenzie, once those water temperature drops, and assuming not a water blowout, we have fishing like right close to town all the way through November if it's stable. Yeah. The key is stability. The fish are there and they're not going to get washed around too much, then the fishing is going to hold up all winter.
But if you get a big like November flood event, that changes it up.
It really does.
Yeah. So that's it. So if you have a low, like this year, if you have a low stable, like it's been, not a lot of rain, pretty, hot, and then it cools down slowly, you could be fishing all the way in front of right in town all the way through November, December sort of thing.
Absolutely. I would say that upper section that we talked about, though, then you're dealing with water temperatures. And once those water temperatures really get cold, that's over for me around Halloween. I struggle to get those fish to move a lot beyond about Halloween now, but the lower reaches really good.
And also there's the lower reaches, there's the Eugene, but there's also, I mean, all the way down into, say, fishing towards like the lower McKenzie, right? Towards like where it goes under I-5. Is that a decent section to be thinking about too?
That's a great section. I mean, it's so underrated. Putting in an Armitage Park puts you in the McKenzie. You're about a mile and a half from the confluence of the Willamette. And then you're so once you're through the McKenzie, you're now on the Willamette, a proper main stem. And now you're going to float down through just tons of gravel bars and drop-offs and banks. And there's a lot. And of course, it's super easy to boat. So anything, I mean, a paddleboard included virtually, is safe. So beginning boaters, great section. You can take out on the river roadside at a Hayes Lane, or you can take out on the Coburg side, which I prefer to, at a place called Christensen Landing. And that's a great section of water.
So yeah, there's tons of, so even through into December, and then at some point, you know, I mean, I guess then you get into transition to really like blue winged olives in wintertime where it can get cold, but even then you might have mild winters, right? Through all the way through January, February.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say anglers need to look at those blue-winged olives though in October, and especially on the upper river too. Like that's sort of your nasty day cold bug, and like we're out there cast, can't find them, can't get them to eat, but there's fish rising all around me. Well, you know, you look really closely, and there's that size 20 sort of iron-colored blue-winged olive that you could barely see. That happens in October, November for sure. I don't think not a lot happens after that. I mean, you don't have too many hatches. I mean, we're going to start looking at blue-winged olives again in February after December.
No, that's good. That gives us a little taste of not only that upper river, but kind of the lower. I want to touch on, before we kind of wrap it up with some of the fishing, I mentioned Jay Nicholas, and he was on way back. He was actually one of our first guests back in episode, I think it was number 3, right? We're at 247 now.
Wow.
On this one. So we've been going since, 2017. And Jay's awesome. I know Jay, and he's been a big part. How did you meet Jay?
Gosh, I just met him at the shop, I think. I mean, I think him and Matt Stansbury, who I mentioned earlier, the blog, may have met through either like Native Fish. I mean, I honestly can't peg it down precisely.
He was just there. He's ingrained into the Caddis Fly Shop.
He is. And then he and I went out fishing and kind of talked about what he could do for me and I could do for him. And we've been friends and colleagues ever since. And he, you know, not only has contributed to the blog, but it contributed to our website a lot. And, has been great throughout since, I can't remember exactly when it was, but let's say, mid 2010, after 2012 on, I suppose. Yeah, maybe earlier than that.
So he's been going strong doing videos, right, that whole time?
Yeah, and he's, also I think he's been integral in some of those sort of fisheries that we wish we had better conditions to attack. His fishing out of Pacific City for, rock bass and salmon and stuff and on the fly, opened people's eyes to some fisheries that maybe they didn't think of as often as they could have. And he was a great contributor to that as well.
That's right. So so you have Jay, and then are there other, a number of other people that are contributing the videos, the tying videos?
Well, lately we've had some, Justin Helm, who works in the shop. I've had, Alex Worth, who, it was, customer fly tire, kids tennis coach, Jim Sens, who's a dedicated angler and fly tire. He also ties some flies for the shop that we sell. Tony Torrance, who has kind of a similar history to the Caddis Fly that I do, although never really worked there a whole lot, but I've always been a contributor and advocate for the shop. So that's why I always say about Eugene too, is that, historically speaking, like we just had a lot of great, fly tires, fishers in the community in our kind of Western Oregon. We've just been lucky that way, you know, to have those guys.
I was thinking, you know, and this is recently, I'm not sure when this came out, because you guys, you guys write different blog posts. Is there a mixture of people that write blog? Because you have the YouTube videos, but you also have the blog. Is that just kind of you and whoever, or who's doing that mostly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm...
You're the main. I see your name out there on a lot of them.
I wish that I had some more contributions. It's a lot harder. I'm sure many people who do blogs or look for content understand how difficult it is to keep something like this going since 2008. It's rough. But anyway, yes, I am doing all that now. I love it when I get contributions from Jay and Matt and others. And, you know, I'm trying to get employees involved and trying to get them to do videos and keep it fresh. But it's can be challenging, and but I've been lucky to have all those guys do it, and you know, I gotta stay on it.
I know that is it. Yeah, I mean, there's companies out there online that have whole teams of people and ambassadors, you know, that are writing and keeping the content. I mean, it's crazy, right, to think, like, Google, you can look at the numbers, but it's so crazy to think how competitive it is to get on, even on first page anymore for stuff.
That's one thing that it was funny. I had that whole the Jay article about fly names, right? That was this sort of solidified my whole position on the internet for, fortunately, I think I've kind of felt this way forever, but like, I remember kind of stressing about all the sort of hate discussion that happened after that. And I was like, then I just kind of came to this realization that, you know, if you're genuine in what you put out there, regardless of what it is, okay, is a conservation, a fishing post, a fishing discussion, a fly tying video, you know, it may not be the greatest quality, but if you're genuine in your intent, I don't want to discuss what you think of it beyond that. And if I don't want to, I don't have to. It's my blog, my content. You know, I mean, it's not for, I'm not working for the national news. And also the whole ranking system about Google and all that, you can't worry yourself as much about that if what you're putting out is intentionally productive to the angling community or any community. You know, don't worry about it after that. And I haven't. I mean, I honestly cannot grind those numbers out. I don't have any desire to do it about analytics. I hope it's going okay. It seems to be. My results speak in my business and lifestyle. So I'm not going to worry about it.
Exactly. No, I agree. I think, yeah, you look at the, you know, your key performance indicators or whatever, you know, I mean, if it's making money, you have a business. I mean, if you're growing the business, then who really cares about what the analytics of Google look like? I mean, it's,
and as you said, there's a lot of people that'll take your money, to try to help you. And I'm not saying that they won't, but look at the long run too.
Yeah. No, I agree. Just, you know, you put something out there that's valuable. That's the bottom line. And yeah, that's, it's right. Interesting. You mentioned the Jay article, because I know Kelly Gallup has been on the podcast a couple times, and I know him just through the podcast, and he's, you know, we've had great conversation. That was really interesting, because I remember when somebody mentioned that, I think I might have posted about Kelly Gallup, and somebody said, hey, you should check out the Oregon Fishing blog about Jay's article. And I was like, oh, and I checked it out, and I was like, well, it was kind of tough, because I know both Jay and I was kind of thinking like the, and I've asked a couple of guests since then what their take was on the naming and stuff. But I mean, what's your take on it? I mean, I guess Jay, he had his take about it, and there's other people. I mean, not to, and I only bring this up because I think it does provide some clarity for people that are into maybe tying flies and what all this history is about. But, you know, do you have a take either way as far as the naming? It seems like, you know, what do you think of, or maybe just talk generally about that article, because I know that kind of went viral, right?
Yeah, it was wild. But no, you know, my take is, in terms of the overall, is just, can we do better on the naming? And to me, the answer is yes. So I don't have a take on who, why, here, how, what, whatever. I just, you know, can we do a better job of being thoughtful in our content and in produce whatever we're doing artistically or otherwise? And, you know, that I think that's the gist of the article. So the part that was weird as the blog manager, and the part that nobody got to see so much, was, you know, the kind of troll type comments, and I think it's just sort of a societal issue at the moment. Maybe it's always been there, but I think that was a really interesting kind of learning experience for me. Like I said, you have to just kind of block that stuff out and say, you know, how much of this is really for real? You know, how much of this sort of hate speech is for real? And I think there are some people who are looking to sort of engage, and I did not engage. And so I feel like that's the right way to play it.
I agree. I think that, I think there was some comments out there from whoever that were like, yeah, you're monitoring, you're letting only the comments you go through. But I agree. It's like, I mean, you know, Jay wrote this article, and you know, if there are trolls out there, which there are, you know, there are people that are trying to do this, trying to stir up stuff, then why would you want that to be? That's not helping anything. I think, and the point you said about moving on is what I think everybody agrees on, the Kelly Gallup thing. It's like, you know, that was a time ago, right? That was back whenever he created those, and it was a different time. You know, exactly. The comedians, I've had some comedians talk about this. I've heard some famous comedians say, you know, it's like Eddie Murphy, right? You go back in the 80s, there's nobody doing Eddie Murphy comedy or what, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not happening. But then it was people did it. And that's the same thing with these naming things. Like Kelly isn't naming his flies whatever porn name anymore. You know, I mean, it's not the same. We're not in the same, you know, deal. So anyways, I appreciate you talking about moving on, because I think that's a great take on the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's how we've all got to learn to do better every day. That's it. You know, that was the message.
Yeah. And did that article, I mean, when you look at, I guess maybe you didn't even look at the analytics, but I mean, did you just see just by the comments, the sheer comments, how much more viral it went compared to other posts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't close. Absolutely. You know, and that's where I reached out to someone in sort of the business of, you know, as a business, are you worried about what the possible, results of you putting this kind of content out there? Do you want to mitigate that, or do you want to just kind of live with it and go with it? You know, and you can break that down further to say, are you worried about losing customers over this or not? Right. I mean, that's the, and do you want to do something or say something that would, stop or sort of try to mitigate what some of these people are saying? And, you know, that's a tough one. That's a tough call for any business. You know, I know some businesses this fall are going through this, you know, do I wear a mask or not? Or do I have my customers wear a mask or not? You know, it's kind of the same thing. Like if businesses want to take a stand, you know, I just applaud those who are willing to take your stand. Okay. Just whatever you believe in, go for it. You know, you can have these people tell you that you're never going to shop with you. They're never going to, I hope you go out of business in 6 months, on and on and on. You got to just stick to your guns. Don't, you know, and, you know, and I think, again, just being genuine in your, in what you believe is going to hold up.
Just to wrap that up, I mean, you could look at a number of different examples, the Orvis stuff with that 50-50 movement when that started, you know, it was a similar deal. They got tons of hate mail and like all sorts of weird stuff. And you're like, wow, I mean, people are against, women. Women in fly fishing, it's like, wow, these are the people. So I just look at it like for you, for a business owner, and you know that, I mean, those definitely aren't the customers you want anyways, right? So it's not like you're losing anybody who's, you know what I mean?
Somebody who doesn't. That's what I want all businesses to understand, is that those people probably weren't your customers anyway. Those really hateful comments are people that are doing that to stir the pot. That's it.
Yeah, I think you handled it well. And I love it because, you know, that article went out there. You had no idea what sort of how it was going to resonate. But, you know, you published it, you know, and people came back and got crazy. But it got people talking, you know, I mean, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I just want to wrap this up. So I have a little segment called the 222 Top Tips, Flies and Resources. And we've nailed a number of these things, but maybe we can just start off with the top flies again. Let's take it back to like mid-October. So if you have to pick two flies, and you may have mentioned them, but what are those two that you have to fish with in your box?
Well, I want to have a Moorish foam October caddis as my dry fly. If I have to pick another dry, it's going to be just a heavy hackle parachute Adams. That's going to be a winner throughout. If I'm going to go subsurface, it's going to be a nymph, a modern nymph with like a jig. And there's a lot of great ones out these days. We'll go with one of our local ones, which is the jigged posse bugger. And that's a great all-around nymph for everything on the Mackenzie all year long, but it's gonna continue to work through the fall.
And are you guys ever even thinking about wet flies at all, or any of that sort of stuff? Is it more just dry surface or down below?
Well, we talked about a section of river that kind of dictated some of that discussion, and that being the upper Mackenzie. So if I can't tell you how much great swing water we have on the Mackenzie and Willamette in the lower reaches. It's so killer. So yes, I love a orange soft tackle in the fall. Love a dark. Let's go back to the original old school wet flies. Let's go to a dark Cahill wet. I mean, great fly. I loved a sort of a thread body, wire ribbed partridge hackle, like Sylvester Neem style soft hackle. It can be a gray, it can be yellow, it could be orange body. Swinging that in the lower Mackenzie is so good. You know, I mean, you know, you just got to avoid the leaves in the late fall and you're catching fish. And there's a tremendous cutthroat population in that lower river, and they absolutely crush wet flies. And I'll even, you know, we did that discussion about the leader. I'll use that same leader. And on my upper wet fly will be like an oversized orange soft tackle. And then down below it, I'll have something a little bit smaller. And you can incorporate like a brass bead or something that's not just crazy heavy in that upper fly. That's going to slow the swing. But oh man, we have some great swing water in lower Mackenzie. It's just not in that upper river where it's just steaming downhill because of the elevational drop. You need to get down below the dam, and ideally you're even lower. Let's, you know, from Hendricks Park all the way to the confluence of the Willamette, if we're talking Mackenzie, and then beyond, that is this primo swing water. And honestly, from a biological standpoint, in terms of spawning habitat and holding some of the overall largest fish in the Mackenzie Basin, Hendricks Bridge to the confluence is it.
Definitely. Okay. And are you guys using like Koffler drift boats? What's your drift boat of choice?
We are using Koffler drift boats. I think almost everybody in our staff is.
That's right. You kind of have to. They're right next door. They're
Well, Joe does a great job. Yeah. He's got a great boat.
Joe's awesome.
He kind of knows how we do it. Yeah.
Are you doing the 16 like by the smaller boat, or what are you doing for your size?
Mine is 16.652. So I think it's a boat that Ken Helfrich designed for the Middle Fork of the Salmon. And it is just ideal for the upper river and dodge and rock side to side, sort of like that Middle Fork of the Salmon in a similar way. And so we don't, you know, I'm not running a 54 wide boat anymore. I did growing up. And even before that, I just had a 1648, you know, just the classic Mackenzie style drift boat. But these a little bit longer boats kind of are great to just both distribute weight and get quick side to side.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned Helfrich. I was talking to him. We did a little mini podcast series on the drift boats. And we had, I think we got about 15 episodes on the whole history, and even got into some of the Grand Canyon, those dories. It was really, really cool. So I'm hoping to get Helfrich, him on as well to keep that story going. So, okay, well, let's take us to back to the 222. So now we're up to some tips. So two tips. So if we're in the drift boat, we're floating down river, we're with you, you know, we got the flies, say it's mid-October somewhere in there. What sort of tip would you give me or somebody out there fishing to help them get into a fish?
Well, if you're in the front of the drift boat, I want you looking ahead all the time, and I want you casting downstream at least down from my oar lock. If we're headed down and you're fishing the right bank, I want you downstream enough so that we're working together. I don't want you casting behind the boat, because now we're dragging the flies downstream. So that's number one. The other is, out of a drift boat, is I don't need too much fly line on the water. So the more fly line you have between you and your flies, and and conceivably the bucket that you've cast into, the more drag that we're going to have that's going to pull those flies out of there. So I need a high rod tip and line management, both entirely from the hand to the fly, meaning less line on the water when you make a mend. Sometimes just holding that line up off the water, not trying to get that kind of, you think of a slower moving flat water situation where you're trying to get that perfect drag free drift, you're just ripping a line off the reel, I'm going to stay shorter and less line on the water for you to get an effective drift. And so I want to kind of keep that fly going as slow as possible.
And are you just using typically, if somebody rod wise, just 9'5" weight, or is there another setup to use there?
Yeah, 9'5" weight is fine. Yeah. A little longer rod. Sometimes guys that prefer that, it's pretty deadly. Kind of what I just, my discussion just there about keeping line off the water and keeping that drift, that long rod is pretty sweet.
Okay. So that gives us a little firepower there. And then just on resource, you mentioned probably the best one, the bug water. Is there another resource or somewhere where you'd direct me? It could be a book, magazine, a video, anything where somebody could dig in more into that fall fishing or even focused on the caddis?
Well, I'd say Oregon Fly Fishing Blog and October Caddis. Yeah, that's a good one. Arlen is a good one. I mean, anything Dave Hughes has ever written about caddis flies is good because Dave knows our area, fishes in our area. That's good. I know that he may not be as, recent as everything he's written about October caddis is fantastic. And I don't want to discount Randall Kaufman and his orange stimulator. It's just not, it's a great fly. I probably wouldn't go out there without having a stimulator. It's just that there's some modern bugs to discuss. So those are really good guys that have, been fishing in our area for a long time, and it's still, those are still really effective flies and tactics for sure.
And that stimulator, that orange bite, I mean, could that just as easy imitate that October caddis?
It would, no question.
I haven't talked to Randall yet, but I think that'd be a cool to get him on and hear the history of some of those flies. Obviously he was it's kind of interesting, right? He was a big influence for a long time. And then, sometimes people disappear, out of the world, it feels like, but you're sticking around, right? You've been doing this a while. What's your plan as you, I'm not sure how many years you've been doing this. What is the next, outlook for you 10 years or so? Look, are you going to keep doing the same?
Well, I think so. It's been awesome. My kids are 14 and 16. I'm getting them to fish around and row around so that's, I want to make sure that they're through high school and all set in college. And I really like to travel and fish, and that's what I've been doing for a while. And I'm going to keep doing that. I might just do a little bit more.
Are you guys doing some of the trout, just like destination stuff around the world sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course we had the lodge in New Zealand for 7 years. So that was what I did in the wintertime from 2013 to 2020.
Oh, amazing. Dang, that's quite a excursion. So you guys had trips and then like just set up trips to the lodge there?
Yeah, we had a lot of it. We had some local customers, but I mean, 90 plus percentage of our customers were from the United States, but all over. Nothing, no specific location. But I mean, Cedar Lodge was one that really had always promoted to the U.S. Clients. And so that's, We were open from November 1st to April 1st, roughly, and that was purchased by a company called 11 Experience in 2020. Yeah, so.
Yeah, we know 11. I had, trying to think, we had at least one guest talked about them. Yeah, they got some good stuff going.
And so I'm done with that and been wintering a little bit in the desert where my daughter plays tennis, but also traveling to fish from there. And yeah, that's the plan for now, is to kind of stay eternal summer. Like once you get hooked on that, it's difficult to get away from it.
I know. That's the thing. When you live in Oregon long enough, you kind of have to start to find your summers. You can't, you can only take so much rain, right?
Exactly. Although, man, this year, we haven't had any.
I know. That's the thing. Yeah. You start to think like, well, maybe you don't have to go anywhere in the winters as this feels like climate change is continuing to keep things warmer and less, well, I don't know if it's less rain. I think it's the same amount of rain. It's just that it comes in big batches all at once.
That's right. I mean, I think we're due. We're so overdue.
Yeah, we're due for a major event.
We really are.
Yeah, major season. Yeah, it'd be nice to get things moving this winter. Cool. Well, I think, Chris, that's about it for you. I guess we'll direct people out to caddisflyshop.com or the Oregon Fishing Blog if people want to connect with you.
That'd be awesome.
Okay. Hey, and one last quick one. I did want to miss this. We've got a little music, a little random section here. We've got a blog or a Spotify channel for the podcast guest. Do you have a band or type of music you like to listen to? We could add to the mix.
Oh man, I'm so. Let's see.
Are you a big music? Are you more a music guy or more a podcast guy?
No, not at all, not at all. I'll have to email you that.
Okay, email it to me. I'll check back with you on it.
I'll consult with my music people here.
Yeah, talk to your music. This will be more of a Caddis Fly Shop selection. And right now, if it's at wetflyswing.com/music, we can all go check out. We got a good random mix from a bunch.
I got
a
shout out to Chris Santella. He must be the music that I would use, wouldn't he? Has anybody ever used his music?
Chris Santella?
Yeah. Oh, have you ever had him on a podcast?
No.
Oh man, you got to have Chris on.
Oh, now who's Chris? Chris is just a fly fishing musician?
No. Chris is a author of 50 Greatest Places to Fly Fish Before You Die, but that would be the work that we'd be most familiar with, but has written a ton of stuff.
Yeah. I know that definitely. That's a huge, huge book. Okay.
He's got a band and I don't even know what it's called. So, but I'll email you.
Good. Yeah, everybody. It seems like everybody. There's a lot of people that even Hafley, right? I don't know if you knew. Hafley used to have a band back in the day. I think he played the drums.
So cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. All right, Chris. Well, I'll let you get out of here. Thanks again for taking the time today and shedding some light on some fall fishing. I hope those people connect with you this fall when this thing gets out. And yeah, man, we'll find some fish. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dave. Have a great day.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links and everything else we covered today, head over to wetflyswing.com/257. If you found some help or use or benefit in this podcast, it'd be great if you could leave a review. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/love. L-O-V-E, love. We'll get you there and show some love and support for the show. I would appreciate that. That is pretty much a wrap for today. We had a good time digging in a little bit on the October caddis from the Caddis Fly Shop. Always fun to talk about that. So hope you found some goodness in this one. And just want to say thanks again for being a listener and following us and showing your support and taking the time to share this out. That's how we've done it over the years. It's been mostly, I don't know exactly, but I think it's been mostly a word of mouth sort of thing. So I hope to see you on the river, maybe online or maybe in a fly shop. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.